Mr. Layton, you may proceed.
May it please the court. Like Mr. Cosgrove, I'll start by talking about the legislature because of the myriad problems that I believe the circuit court decision has. There are two that I'd like to emphasize. So before the legislature today, there are two bills, well, there are more than that, but two of them. One of them would increase the minimum number of hours required for school districts to provide by 36 hours. The other one would increase the foundation formula for the schools by $60 million. If both of those pass, as written, because there is no line item in the appropriations bill for those 36 hours, if both of those bills pass as written, then the school districts for these taxpayers get the $60 million and don't have to provide even one additional minute of instruction. That is not what the Hancock Amendment requires. That is not what the drafters intended. That is not something you can reconcile with the purposes of the Hancock Amendment. That result comes from two errors, two among the errors of the circuit court. The first error is the circuit court held, in essence, that absent a specific line item in an appropriations bill for each and every year, for each and every state requirement that is expanded or made anew since 1980, there has to be a specific line item in the appropriations bill. Otherwise, the school districts are completely absolved from complying with that expanded or new requirement, even if they get money through another appropriation sufficient to cover it, even if they get money from third parties like those who pay for concealed carry permits to cover it, even if they get tuition to cover it, it doesn't matter. If there isn't a line item, according to the circuit court, that's it. For every single thing that's happened since 1980, 33 years.
So to extend that, if he would challenge the ability of the Department of Education to supervise schools, for example, if the Department of Education said, we require every school to teach Missouri history.
Then if there were not a line item for that particular thing, then every school district would be absolved from complying with it, even if they got money through the foundation formula sufficient to cover it. That's the holding.
Does the fact that the money goes with the student cure any Hancock problem?
No, the fact that money goes with the student actually, no. I mean, I don't think that creates a problem, nor that it solves a problem. The Hancock Amendment doesn't worry about that. The Hancock Amendment is worried about whether a taxpayer is going to have to pay more or get fewer services from their local political subdivision by virtue of what it is the state legislature has done. So the second point where the circuit court ruled that leads to my conclusion is that the court held that unless the line item, now it's not explicit, but this is the result, unless the line item is enough to cover not just past or present or even certain future costs, but all costs that the taxpayer can persuade a circuit judge will be incurred at some point, then the political subdivision is not required to comply, even to the extent that compliance is paid for by the state. That's the whole thing.
Is there actually any place in the court's decision that says you have to have a line item? Or are you just saying that was the lack of a line item was what they relied on to show that they didn't get additional funding?
No, the problem is that the court relied on this court's decision in RALA 31 to say that there has to be a specific appropriation. The only kind of appropriations we have are line items.
Said is they're imposing an additional duty and you didn't appropriate any additional money for that purpose. So is that a line item, or is that just saying you didn't appropriate any additional money? For them to implement this would cost them money.
The problem with that is, I mean, let me take the 36 hours provision. Mm-hmm. There will be nothing, absent a line item, there will be nothing passed by the General Assembly that we could point to and say that money is for that item, that it's a specific appropriation.
But you're adding in things that are not in the trial court's opinion. You're saying this court would say you can't simply say we appropriated an extra $30 million and we impose new duties and they equal out.
Because the only way the legislature can say that is through a line item. There's no other way for the legislature to say that it's a specific.
Well, the way the trial court said it is you appropriated zero, but you imposed duties, therefore they weren't paid for.
That's because the trial court refused to consider the possibility that the increases, substantial increases, that any portion of the $56 million that the state pays to the St. Louis Public Schools every year could be attributed or could be used to cover this or any other
requirement. And that's a different argument, which is that you're arguing it's okay to move money from one purpose to another purpose, which is very different than saying you have to have a line item for each purpose.
No, because the problem with the moving in purposes is that some portion of that $56 million that goes to the St. Louis schools is presumably for matters that have been required by the state, either before 1980 or since 1980. But we have no evidence in this case about what portion of that $56 million is available to the state to reallocate for the St. Louis schools to pay tuition for the Brightonville children or any other children. Because these parties, these taxpayers, and again, I talk about taxpayers because this isn't about the school districts. These taxpayers refuse to provide sufficient information, well, any information, on which the trial court could decide how much of that $56 million is available for the legislature to say that's to cover this particular item.
So your argument would be if you provided more funds than you mandated expenditures for in the past, that's a fund that's there that can be used to cover any future duties which
Absolutely.
Are imposed.
Absolutely.
Is there any case that addresses that?
No, because this court has never been asked that. To the extent the court has addressed it, it's in Rolla 31, and the court said, in essence, no. And in that case, the court is wrong. Now, understand, that may be dicta in that case, because in that case, there's no question about the application of the Section 21 to the school district, to Rolla 31. The provision at issue in that case said that 10%, not of 10% of even the first dollar that the school district pays for early childhood education has to be out of the local pocket. So in that case, that should have been the end of the analysis. The rest of the analysis in that case is it may not be dicta, but it ought to be dicta. There is no case in which the court has said that the General Assembly, other than that, that the General Assembly can't or has or can't reallocate funds that are not Hancock protected to cover costs such as the costs of compliance with 167-131.
But Hancock does say you can't impose a new duty without paying for it. I'm still unclear. I mean, I can see where you could argue the state could take away voluntary funds in future years.
Right.
But the issue for Hancock.
There's no
what
difference.
Language in Hancock are you relying on for your argument?
Well, there's no difference between taking away $1 million that we don't have to give to a political subdivision and counting that $1 million for a new requirement. I mean, otherwise, this is purely form over substance, that we can take away the $1 million as long as we give it back to you with this tie with it. Of course, the court in Rolla 31 said you can't actually do that, but again, nothing in the Hancock Amendment supports that particular conclusion. It's not intended to be protection for political subdivisions that they are forever going to get every penny the state has ever given them.
So there can never be a Hancock violation unless a district, a political subdivision, proves that they don't have $1 of extra money that they're not required to spend.
Unless they prove that the amount that the state is giving them today is not sufficient to cover the mandates that the state had in 1980 and has imposed since 1980, until that taxpayer proves that, there's no violation.
For everything that the state gives them, not just in this area.
Everything that is available to be used to fulfill that mandate. Now, for example, we couldn't say, okay, the state has given you so many $100,000 for early childhood education, which is the one light item that exists after Rolla 31 that's pertinent here. The state couldn't say, well, we give that to you, so we get to count that for 167-131 transfers, because they can't use it.
You're
for
just
that.
Saying education money. Look at if they have extra education money or any general funds.
Education money that is not allocated to other things, that is available to be used for these kinds
just
of transfers.
Before you run out of time, can you?
Yeah, and I'm going to try and give my counsel 2 minutes.
Okay. Who's addressing the mootness point?
Well, I can to some extent. The St. Louis School District itself is now accredited. There is no potential for the doomsday scenario on which the circuit court relied. That is, assuming that it is possible to say that if you can't take everyone, you don't have to take anyone, a position that I don't think has any support in the Hancock Amendment, then that is gone. On the other hand, there is still a substantial attorney's fees award from these taxpayers, for these taxpayers, and the Brightonville children are still arguing over whether who needs to pay tuition for them.
It's provisional accreditation. What's that mean?
Well, in terms of the Hancock amendment, or in terms of 167.131, it doesn't
back
matter.
Back to the mootness aspect of it.
Yeah, it doesn't.
It says accredited, but it says provisionally accredited. What's that mean?
It doesn't mean anything under 167.131. Whether it's provisional or full accreditation doesn't make any difference. The moment that the school district became provisionally accredited, the students no longer had a right under 167.131. The school district, St. Louis School District, was then obligated to open their doors to those students just as they are obligated today. If every student in every parochial school in St. Louis and every private school in St. Louis today decides, forget it, we're going to the public schools, they have to take all of those students tomorrow. Thank you.
Mr. Layton, before you sit down, if there is a violation of the unfunded mandate provision, does that make the statute invalid? Or is it simply a defense against the enforcement of that statute?
I believe it is solely a defense against enforcement of that statute.
So what is the constitutional jurisdiction for us to entertain this appeal? Which it certainly can't be the sentence that says that we will hear appeals dealing with the validity of the statute.
That's a good question, Your Honor. I'd have to think further about that one.
Well, maybe the respondents will have an answer given the head start they have.
Maybe.
We're going to give an extended period to the 5 minutes more to co-counsel.
Since I took up all of Mr. Layton's time, you get 5 minutes more if you'd like to make your argument.
That's the Stitz rule. No, I'm just saying. 5 minutes for your co-counsel, 5 minutes more for your co-counsel, even Stephen. Who wants to ask questions?
Thank you. With respect to the question you asked, Justice Teitelman, about the provisional accreditation, it's mystified me, particularly in the last 6 months or so, since the St. Louis Public School District gained provisional accreditation, because you don't find that in the statute. And it strikes me as there's some ironies in this case. Obviously, Ms. Breitenfeld, along with her colleagues initiated this case in 2007. This case has now gone on so long and has been so involved that either because the children of the three other parents have graduated from high school, those families no longer have standing, or because of the withering exhaustion that they have suffered by virtue of the complexity and length of this case, those three other parties are no longer involved. And it's been stated by our opponents that we haven't demonstrated, Ms. Breitenfeld has not demonstrated reliance on 167.131. And that plainly cannot be true. The record in this case since 2007 demonstrates that. All this court needs to do is to examine the district's briefs. And it's conceded that because the Clayton School District would not follow 167.131 in the summer of 2007, Ms. Breitenfeld and now her fallen comrades had to initiate litigation, which then wended its way through the judicial system, landed before you, resulting in your June 23rd, 2010 opinion in the Turner case, in which you declared that 167.131 is a straightforward and unambiguous statute that plainly applied given the factual scenario of this case. Ms. Breitenfeld stuck with it on remand. We believe that the trial court's granting the district's right or the ability to amend their pleadings to raise constitutional defenses 4 years into the litigation was untimely. And the reason I mention that here is not only because we've raised that as a point, but because it goes to Ms. Breitenfeld's reliance and the unfairness that would be really that she would suffer if the counterclaim judgment is allowed to stand. If you look at the cases that we've cited on prospective versus retrospective application, it occurs to me that Ms. Breitenfeld is the archetype of a person one who could be exempted from the retrospective application of the statute. And we believe that actually this court could grant the statute retrospective application as to everybody else in the state of Missouri but her. She is the one who asserted her rights under this statute for lo these many years and relied on it. And indeed, she relied on this court's opinion, June 23, 2010, that it's a straightforward and unambiguous statute that applies to the facts of these case, the facts of this case. And it was over her objection that the districts were allowed to raise these defenses, which ironically now, the Clayton School District is saying, causes her to owe the Clayton School District $49,133 for tuition. And we think that's blatantly unfair. We don't think that if you read the Bloomquist, the Sumner, and the Trout cases cited in our brief, that this is really a question of equity where she had to raise something in her pleading.
Opposing counsel says that charge that they claim a right to is based on her affidavits not being accurate or true, not on the substance of the underlying cause of action.
It seems to me, first of all, that what that's attempting to do is to conflate the question of whether it's fair to grant only prospective application of the court's ruling to Ms. Breitenfeld with the concept, an equitable concept of unclean hands. We don't think that's what it is. Again, if you look at the Bloomquist, Sumner, and Trout cases, it's a question of kind of fundamental fairness. And secondly, as a matter of fact in this case, raising those things, these affidavits that supposedly are false, which we think the evidence is not sufficient to support that statement, we stipulated as to who was residing where, when. And it seems to kind of, the fact that the parties agreed in the, I believe, the Clayton School District's own words, to compromise on that issue for purposes of the trial, kind of removes from the case any unfairness by virtue of her supposed, in Clayton School District's worldview, wavering concepts as to where she would live. The parties ended up stipulating. It seems to me that it's irrelevant. This is the person, the last remaining person in this case, upon whose back the justiciability of 167.131 now resides. But for her, this case would have fallen apart. And I think if you take a look at this case, the practical reality is the districts want to be here now. How did they get here now? We think untimely raising defenses, which are not consistent with this court's precedents as to when you must raise constitutional defenses, but they are here now. And they've prevailed, and it's because Ms. Breitenfeld was still here relying on the statute.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, I'm going to save you time by asking you a question. Now, in the concealed carry case, we said, I believe I was in the dissent, but we said that the local government can move money around, even though there was no specific appropriation for administrative costs for processing concealed weapons registration. It was presumed that the local community could move their money around and take care of it.
Actually, we held it was improper in violation of Hancock because it wasn't specifically designated for the purpose required.
Well, good.
Yeah, Your Honor, I'm not sure I understand your question, Your Honor.
We did uphold the concealed carry.
No, in Brooks, you held that it was improper and it was a violation of the Hancock Amendment in order to have a administrative fee that was charged that wasn't fully funded by the state. And in that case, you asked for specific information. It was only a $38 amount. You held that it only had to be something that was more than de minimis. It is $38 amounts. May it please the court and Solicitor General and Mr. Kistner, we believe that there are ample independent grounds to sustain the court's judgment. This is a case that is a simple case for affirmance for violation of the Hancock Amendment. It fits with the judiciable history of that amendment over the last 32 years. The state is, in effect, asking you to overrule your past, not just one case, but almost all of them, Rolla 31, Jefferson 1 and 2, the Brooks case, because what they want you to find is that there are new requirements in order to find a violation of the Hancock Amendment.
Are you arguing there has to be a line item for each specific expenditure, as argued by Mr. Layton?
I don't believe that's what the court found below. I don't believe that is a requirement.
What is your response to his argument then that it was your duty to prove that you couldn't use voluntary funds that they had, the state had paid you to pay for these increased costs?
Because in contrast to a Hancock claim that involves a reduced amount of funding, you know, that's the first part of the Hancock Amendment. The second part is a new mandate. A new mandate or an increase in an existing mandate specifically said it has to be fully funded. Here, the state admitted that there was no funding mechanism for this mandate whatsoever. There was no funding for it. Now, they alluded to the fact
that did this statute exist before the Hancock Amendment?
A predecessor to the statute existed before the Hancock Amendment. The statute itself did not, Your Honor. And in fact,
the same
repealed and reenacted.
The obligation existed before the Hancock Amendment.
No, it didn't, Your Honor. It didn't.
Yeah, that was a question. It wasn't a statement.
Right. I'm sorry. Yeah. So in 1980, when the Hancock Amendment was existed, there was a predecessor statute. We set forth on page 32 of our brief where we show with red line and crossouts what changed. Here are the mandates that are different and changed, okay, with respect to, and I'll take them individually. First of all, with respect to these two individuals, the two Breitenfeld children, there was no mandate whatsoever for these children to be educated in this method with this tuition before the 1993 School Act. There was none, okay, because the old statute specifically said that all you had to complete the highest grade in the district that you were in. And then if they didn't have an approved high school, then you can go to a different district.
How do you distinguish those sorts of things from the legislature passing a statute that says now you have to teach 2 years of Missouri history? Would you, under your analysis, wouldn't that be a violation of the Hancock Amendment also?
Well, I think that before the court could rule on that and before I could analyze it, I'd have to go back and look at what were the prior mandates. There were substantial mandates in the past as to teaching specific classes,
What if they took out math and science and added two history classes? Is that a wash or is it new?
It could be. It depends on the facts of that particular case. Those facts aren't before this court, Your Honor, because in this case, we're not talking about moving one for another. There's no doubt, in fact, the state didn't even address it in their reply brief, that here for these individual students, one's an elementary school child, one's in middle school, there was no requirement whatsoever pre-1993 that their tuition be paid for those persons or that they attend a different school. That's one clear new thing. The second new mandate is transportation that wasn't provided beforehand. The third new thing is that there was accreditation according to by district now. In the past, it only said an approved school. There is no statewide accreditation of individual schools, just districts now. All of these are new mandates. And
of course, the substitution, 93 Act, was substituted for the federal requirement or supremacy clause that because of the history of Missouri, of these districts in discrimination, that there should be busing, and the federal court ordered it, and the state of Missouri paid it.
Well, Your Honor, I think that was part of Senate Bill 781 and the Lindell desegregation settlement. I think that's what you're talking about. The 1993 right. Act is something that applied statewide. I don't think it was connected to that.
Your opponent argues, did they not, the state, that there was a mandate to provide education to these children, and the mandate was to provide education within the district, and that's no different than being required to provide it outside the district.
Right, and the reason that's not accurate, Your Honor, is that we know under Statute 167.031, there is no obligation to educate a child in the district, for the school district, unless that individual presents itself to the school. And then there are needful rules that are set forth in order to educate them in the particular school that they're done. The parent has an obligation to educate a child. That can be through public schools, through charter schools, through homeschooling, through religious schools, private schools, etc. But we know that under 167.031, the school district in a particular political subdivision is only required to educate those students that present themselves. We also know that under 130-163-0112, that the foundation formula money that the state is saying, well, you can just take some of that, it does not apply to students that are not going to school in that district. It specifically says the student has to reside in the district and go to a school in that district.
Opposing counsel says if we were to agree with that argument, it would undermine funding of all sorts of other programs and all sorts of other transfers, special school district, and so forth.
Well, I think that's completely inaccurate, Your Honor. And the reason I think it is because if you look at the special school district, for example, this is a perfect example of why this is not applicable here. Under the Individuals with Disability Education Act, which we set forth in our brief, the city is required to educate those handicapped students in their district. That's the testimony of trial was 15% of the students in the district qualify for that, have some sort of disability that have to be educated. Now, the county districts have banded together and do that through a special school district. The evidence at trial, there was a stipulation between all the parties, all of them, that special school district and those county districts are not required and would not provide special education for any transfer students. So in effect, if you wanted to have 167-131 apply to individuals that would apply for that, it would be transferred out but then have to be transferred back in for their special educational needs. That's what would happen. That's why that was part of the impossibility argument, that you can't comply as a legal requirement to educate those students where they reside and to comply with, you know, IDEA and with the other requirements for educating special needs students.
And is one of you going to talk about impossibility? I don't want to ask the wrong person that.
Well, I'd be happy to briefly address it, Your Honor. The points that we raise in our brief are, number one, from a factual standpoint, financial impossibility. We already went through these particular students. These two students we know violate the Hancock Amendment because we got $80,000 that we have to pay for these two students for 2 years in which they're trying to seek this tuition.
Why don't you get enough money transferred from the city to cover that cost?
I'm sorry?
You don't get enough money from the city to transitional school district to cover that cost?
Well, I represent the transitional school district. Yeah. We would be paying that cost. We'd be getting a bill from the city of Clayton, writing a check for $80,000.
Is that not money that you get from the state? I'm sorry.
We do not. Even for these particular students, it's very clear under 163-011, we haven't received a penny for them over those last 2 years because they never attended St. Louis Public Schools, ever, never resided in the school, okay? But even if you accepted the state's argument that DESE somehow disregards that statute and still applies the foundation formula money, the state's the city's average weighted amount is $3,600. The tuition amount is $20,000. So there's over $16,000 in unfunded mandates, even if you accept their position that you could fund it.
And the latter part, you're saying they right now a lot of the students don't go to public schools in the city. They may go to charter schools or private schools, but they would be entitled to take advantage of the transfer, and therefore you'd pay for them where you hadn't previously.
Yes, Your Honor, 167-131 makes no distinction between whether or not they attended the school now or had in the past. The old statute, before the 1993 amendment, said you had to attend the school up to its highest grade, and then we talk about an approved high school. Here, these particular students, for example, elementary school, middle school, never do it. That's part of the new mandate. Okay? If we apply those figures over the amount of people that are going to transfer, the expert's opinion was over 15,000 people are going to transfer. And to your point, Judge Stith, there were 8,000 of those
people. But there weren't 15,000 people that transferred, were they?
There were 15,000 people that were projected to transfer.
But that's speculation.
And now with the reaccreditation, isn't that all mooted out? So isn't that a possibility argument out the window?
Well, let me address the mootness for one. Number one, there's the real controversies of the $80,000 I told you about. There's the real controversy of the attorney's fees associated with the violation of the Hancock Amendment. I also want to address the public policy of the concept of capable of repetition but evading review, especially here where the head of DESE, when we were reaccredited, provisionally reaccredited, and what that means, Justice Teitelman, is that you have between 6 and 8 of the 14 requirements of the MSIP, Missouri School Improvement Act, that's covered in our brief, I think on page 32 as well, That provisional accreditation, which means it's not covered by 167-131 anymore, but the head of DESE at that time, and this is in the supplemental record, said, but you could be reaccredited, unaccredited again in the fall because of the new MCIP 5 that's coming in. But in particular, with respect to the mootness issue, capable of repetition but evading review, here, the mootness of it, if you say, gee, if you get accredited, it's controlled by the party that would be paying the money under the Hancock Amendment, because the state is the one that controls whether or not we're accredited or not. And so this is the best example of where you could pull out the rug anytime you want, right before the Supreme Court, accredited, okay? And then when we go back down, unaccredited, and we're back in the same place.
So you're suggesting it's not moot?
It's not moot, Your Honor. I believe it isn't.
But what about the impossibility argument?
See, when you take the impossibility argument, take the big numbers, the 15,000, that's a projected amount. We don't believe it's speculative. Speculative is not something that's done by an expert. The state had all the time, information in the world, and could come in and have someone testify as to how many that were transferred. They didn't do that. There's no witness that says it's going to be less than that
but
amount.
But how many actually transferred?
Well, under this 167-131, zero, because the county schools did not accept it. Remember, when it first happened, DESE said, don't accept people under that. Okay? Don't accept people under that. But if you want to talk about people who actually transferred, let's look at transferees in the VIC program, the Voluntary Interdisciplinary Choice Corporation. And the testimony trial was there was 5,500 children that transfer out of this city every year under the VIC program. 11,000 apply. 11,000 apply.
What was the number of calls they got inquiring about the program? Wasn't it something like less than 500?
Yes, the testimony from the school district was a number of hundreds because they stopped taking names or people wouldn't leave names. But we know from the VIC program that there's a double amount. There's 5,500 that would apply. And the testimony from the superintendent Adams, who's sitting in the courtroom today, was that if you had even a fourth the number of people, the 15,000, who applied for that, it would devastate the district. It wouldn't be able to operate.
If this court accepted your proposed definition of impossibility, wouldn't that allow any political subdivision, for example, to just say, well, we don't have the money, therefore it's impossible?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because I think that we demonstrated an incredible amount of facts supporting the fact that it would be possible for the district to occur.
Say hypothetically there was a fund called the Second Injury Fund that didn't have any money, and there were people who had valid judgments against it, which had already been approved and appealed and whatever, but then they just raised the defense of, we have no money, it's impossible. Would that legally resolve them of having to pay those judgments?
Your Honor, I didn't address that because not just factually do we not have the money, we can't do it legally. We can't comply with the Individuals with Disabilities Act, we can't comply with the Lindell Desegregation Act, we can't comply with this state's pronouncements under 162-1100 for the city's district to regain accreditation. That's what they did, that only through the funds that were available, and those efforts would not have been able to be completed.
But the city can choose not to intervene in TIF cases and not, I mean, how many TIF cases has the city gotten involved in the city of St. Louis?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. That's our
problem. I mean, that's the revenue for the city schools.
Well,
I mean, we take TIFs and you give out a lot of TIFs in the city of St. Louis. I mean, other districts do intervene for their interest in the school, tax. If you don't intervene for TIFs, then you're not pursuing all your remedies for funding for the school district in the city of St. Louis.
I represent the taxpayers in a school district.
Right.
The city may or may not intervene.
How about the schools? The schools have an interest in TIFs.
Some of the TIF money goes to schools. Some of it does not.
Well, no. I mean, it's tax money. Tax money available to the schools. The schools can intervene in TIFs, and I don't know whether the city is saying, you say you don't do that.
No. The point, Your Honor, is that you can't take local money. The one thing we do know from the Hancock Amendment is the state can't force a political subdivision to take its other tax funds and pay it for something that it mandated to be new.
But school taxes are part of what you do with TIFs, which are real estate taxes. Real estate taxes are a prime source of income for schools.
But I don't know how that relates to the Hancock Amendment issue before the court.
Well, because you're saying it's impossible, but if you don't pursue income for the schools, then you're not going to have the money. But,
and your point is you're not required to use local money, even if there were no TIFs, to
right.
meet a state mandate.
Total operating budget's $288 million. The projected amount on the first wave would be about $280 million. So by anyone's standards of impossibility, it would take all that TIF money, all the
first wave
local
you're talking
money.
About, what, the 15,000 or 5,000?
The projected 8,000 people from the city schools and the other 7,000 from charter schools or others that would be transferring over as well, Your Honor. In assuming in them is the 5,500 double amount from the VIC program. Now, my learned colleague would like to
thank you.
Include
that. You have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Judge. I'm Mark Bremer again for the Clayton School District and the taxpayers of the Clayton School District. The language of the Constitution, as this court has remarked on a number of occasions, is unmistakably clear. With respect to a post-Hancock mandate, there must be full state funding by means of an appropriation made and dispersed by the state to the political subdivision. Whatever the problems may be of complying with that literal language in any other case, and these other issues and hypothetical scenarios.
So what does it do with the regulatory structure? What if the DESE says you should teach English? They mandate you teach English. Can you say you have to fund that?
I don't know what all the facts are about that.
How about
not this case? I don't know. We do know that the people in 1980 made it very clear whenever the state legislature decides to impose a mandate on the local political subdivision, such as a school district, they've got to very clearly lay out the amount of money they are going to commit to that. And if there's an issue about the situation you described, Your Honor, the legislature, again, specifically pursuant to express provision in the Hancock Amendment, can adopt implementing legislation. So if there's an issue there, does this fit or does this not fit within the Hancock Amendment, the legislature can speak to that. They have not done that here.
Is the legislature required to line item if they added English, have to say, we're giving you $10 million for this, or can they appropriate a sum of money for a variety of obligations or duties or tasks?
I believe this court's opinions make it clear there is flexibility there. Whether it is a particular line item, let me address that first, and then I'll give you some other examples this court has approved. Line items are not the end of the world. They're not a problem. In the education appropriation bills that we had in evidence before the court below, there are dozens and dozens of line items. There are hundreds of millions that go to fund the foundation formula. There's a significant amount that very comfortably complies with this court's opinion in RALA 31 and every year appropriates a line item amount for the preschool special services that this court held needed to be separately appropriated. They've done it every year in the decades since. And there are line items as small as $1,200 in the appropriation bill. Now, there are other ways you can do it, and this court has said so. In RALA 31, there was a set-aside. I don't know if that's a line item or if that's different, but this court said that would be compliant, that set-aside there. In the Jefferson City 2 case, there was another mechanism where the legislature set up a fund to cover something they had decided to mandate, and this court said that's okay. As soon as that money is received, then there's an obligation to comply
with
the mandate.
Have any of our prior cases addressed whether the state can say you have to prove that you don't have any monies left over after doing all previously mandated activities and you can't use any leftover monies to fulfill this mandate before we're required to give you more?
No, Your Honor, because that is a conflation of another provision in the Hancock Amendment. That is the provision that covers pre-existing mandates, mandates that existed before the Hancock Amendment was adopted. As to them, there is this ratio analysis to determine whether the ratio of state funding has changed. Totally different situation. This court in its prior rulings has made it clear that's a different issue. You don't get into ratio analysis with respect to post-Hancock mandates because the language is there must be full funding for the new mandate by an appropriation made and dispersed. That does not admit the use of or allow the use of the pre-existing mandate ratio formulation. We don't have to show the history of what was paid in the past and how that may have changed, how the ratios have changed. Not required where we have a new mandate case.
Counsel, do your clients agree that there were no children that actually transferred under this statute in this period of time that St. Louis was unaccredited?
We do have the Breitenfeld children. We have two and one-third years in play as to each of those two children. And we proved a Hancock violation in the past and up to the time of trial with respect to those two, without regard to the Jones projections.
But they didn't attend pursuant to the statute, so how did you prove a Hancock violation as to them?
Well, they put in issue that their attendance is pursuant to the statute.
They're arguing they shouldn't have to pay tuition because
Correct.
They should have been
And
committed.
Our defense to that was the statute is unenforceable. It violates Hancock, and it's impossible.
But
so that issue is squarely presented, Your Honor.
But traditionally, Clayton High School, the thing the schools have taken kids on who pay tuition to the Clayton School District.
Yeah, there we've taken
on your own.
We have in the past, and that was in the record and discussed quite a bit in Turner One, mm-hmm. the first case. We
and as I recall, there was no limitation as far as numbers that you would take, so long as they could pay tuition.
No, the Clayton School District is very carefully calculating as to the numbers it can take because it doesn't have a lot of excess capacity. So they were very careful in exercising their discretion as to how many tuition students they would take, how many of the VIC transfer students they would take. They're a big historic promoter of that program. And they always had to be very careful to put them in to the classrooms where they may have space. And that was always done by the administration very deliberatively. And it's important that they be able to do that. And in this statutory program, we have the exact opposite of that. There is no ability to plan. There is no ability to put those kids into the right places.
But isn't your remedy, though, to go to the legislature and have them change it if you're right on that and you've been unsuccessful in doing that?
I believe the statute's unconstitutional. And I believe, pursuant to this court's mandate, we proved impossibility with evidence that is solid and comprehensive, which was our understanding this court asked us and Judge Vincent to do. And we diligently did that. We proved both a Hancock violation, and we have also proved impossibility. And as to impossibility, I don't even think that's moot because, as Mr. Walsh pointed out, that is an issue capable of repetition yet evading review, especially when the evasion of review is within the control of the party to be bound. And I'll say this. If Judge Vincent hadn't struck down the enforceability of this statute, we have every reason to believe, based on the substantial, indeed overwhelming, indeed uncontested evidence below, that 15,000 kids would have left the city and gone to the county, that 3,500 kids would have gone to the Clayton School District, which only has a capacity.
Opposing counsel says that's all speculation.
The reason it didn't happen is because the statute was held unenforceable by Judge Vincent several months before
August. Did opposing counsel put on a different expert to counter your expert or object to the admission of your expert's
no
testimony?
No controverting evidence.
Okay. What was avoiding these 15,000 people from going to Clayton High School or Clayton School District and say, we want in? What was stopping them?
Nothing, Your Honor. Unless.
So why didn't they do it if they were wanting to
Why didn't
do
it occur? Because Judge Vincent struck down the statute on May 1. That's why they didn't show up in August. If he had
but
struck
this
going,
it down. But we decided our case in, what was it, 2010? I mean, from 2010 until Judge Vincent struck it down, why weren't all these people applying the school district?
Because, Your Honor, in this court's remand, you sent it back for a resolution of all issues using this court's exact.
We just reversed summary judgment.
Not resolved.
We just reversed summary judgment in that prior
Correct.
Decision.
And you sent it back down to us and say allow defenses to be asserted. And both the dissent and the majority spoke about whether this would be impossible. And the majority in particular said, we're not going to reach a judgment on that without evidence, because that had gone up on summary judgment. Now you've got the evidence. It is impossible, and it is an issue evading review and capable of repetition. If I could just
Do you agree also that what cuts against determining that this case is moot is the fact, and not that this litigation has just existed to put this decision off. Sometimes there's lots of things complicated that require litigation to go on for years, but. If this case isn't decided, I mean, they'll have to start with a sixth grader next time, right, to make sure that it can get through everything it needs to do in order for the court to resolve the issue.
Or more specifically, Your Honor, when MCIP 5 standards, very rigorous, go into effect, Mr. Walsh's client may again have trouble complying with this come this fall, and they will then, conceivably, they could lose their provisional accreditation and become unaccredited, which means we're right back. And all
well,
that
there's
same
a lot of machinery that goes on. Once they're accredited, then they have an elected school board again. They you know, at some point, they won't have the provisional board, the transitional board anymore. A lot of things will go on that make it very much very difficult to go back and forth every couple months.
It's a complicated situation, but it's a very realistic possibility, Your Honors, that the statute's going to apply again, kids can leave the city, and the same projections would be as sound then at time of trial as it would be, another portion of a year from now. If I might just briefly address one issue regarding the Breitenfeld judgment. There's been some question raised as to whether we proved up the amount owed. Now, all of the defenses about what's equitable, whether there's reliance, retroactive, prospective, those are all equity doctrines, affirmative defenses that were not pled, they were not proven, and there was no evidence at all put on to support them. But I want to point out one thing. The numbers that come up with the $49,000 figure are derivable from specific exhibits in the record. In particular, the tuition, the amounts involved here, the per diem, are what the annual tuition amounts were before this court, and you can compute the exact
amount. What about Mr. Kistner's point that this suit was filed, you absolutely knew they lived in the city, they were seeking to transfer under the statute, whatever their affidavits may have said. City of Clayton was perfectly aware that they lived in the city, yet it allowed them to attend. So it's unfair to say they misrepresented per the affidavits because everybody knew what was going on.
Yeah, the affidavits falsely stated that the kids lived in the city.
But
and thereafter,
but
it was stipulated that, I'm sorry, that they lived in Clayton. That's what the affidavit said. And thereafter, it became stipulated that that was untrue. And that
but Clayton continued to let them attend then.
Pardon me?
But Clayton continued to allow them to attend.
Merely to preserve the status quo, to protect the interests of children rather than all of us adults. We have our dispute, but the Clayton School District puts the interests of children first
but
allowed it to happen.
But their argument is it's unfair to come back after the fact then and say they owe $49,000 when if that was going to be, you should have told them that up front.
This case was tried, the pleadings show this, the colloquy that occurred in open court confirms this. This case was tried on the premise that if the statute is unenforceable, then Gina Breitenfeld owes the tuition. If it's enforceable, then it was our position, the city district owed. There was no question about that.
But that amount of money, the Breitenfelds stuck with this case for a long time. That amount of money is not going to break the city or break Clayton, is it? Whatever money. $80,000, $49,000, that's clearly possible to pay.
Clayton has absorbed it thus far. It has a judgment, and it is duty as a public entity to try to collect that money to protect the interests of the Clayton taxpayers. We don't give away as a public entity. We may not do that under this, under the Constitution of this state. And I'll tell you this. If this guy's client has to pay for it, just for the Blightonville children alone, that is at least one public school teacher that would have to be let go in the city district. This money matters. And it affects the interests of children.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Judge Wilson, I still don't have a good answer for you on jurisdiction. As a former clerk for Judge Robertson, who took a narrow view of what constitutes the construction of revenue law, I can see where you might go and would simply request that if this court is about to say that the Hancock cases ought not come here originally, that we would prefer not to incur additional attorney's fees by having to go to the Eastern District and then return to this court. Second, the state did not object to the intervention of the taxpayers. The state wasn't a party in the case until the taxpayers intervened. And so that's why the state could, I suppose, have come in and said it was improper to have them intervene. We didn't do that because the taxpayers could have filed their own independent suit and we would have been in exactly the same position. But I would note that there was a really curious statement made a few minutes ago, and that was that the districts didn't want to have to pay the tuition or enroll the Brightonville children because they had the Hancock Amendment as a defense. This court has repeatedly said districts cannot assert the Hancock Amendment as a defense. That is simply wrong. Next, a really curious statement that at the time, before 1993, there was no accreditation process. The MSIP 5 requirements are coming in. We have all these additional requirements we have to meet. You know, there are no line items, or if there is something other than a line item that would qualify as a specific appropriation, although I still don't know what that is. There is no line item to cover any of those things. I don't understand how it is that an attorney who represents the school district could stand up and say, you can't bind us by something without that kind of appropriation, but we're bound by something that doesn't have that kind of appropriation, and we're going to have these dire consequences because of that. Judge Stith, you asked about the impact of the holding that the foundation formula will not pay for students who are not actually attending a school that's operated by the district. You didn't get an answer to that. You got an answer dealing with the special school district, IDA and IDEA and the like. That is not the answer to that question. It doesn't answer that question. At least three of the members of the court used to be at high schools that probably had students or were in towns that had students who came from these K-8 districts. This would be devastating to those K-8 districts were the court to go the direction that these lawyers want you to go. And
but,
it would be devastating.
But other than saying it was devastating, I didn't see you answer that in your
brief.
Well,
the state has for decades interpreted the statute, applied the statute in a way to say that if you have a resident student, you can educate that student in your schools, but you can also pay, whether it's because they're handicapped or because you don't have a high school, you can pay for it to be somewhere else. The statute doesn't expressly grant that authority, but that has been the practice for decades. There was a statement that the Clayton District, and that, by the way, the fact that Clayton District and the St. Louis District, one of them could have a Hancock claim and the other would not have one. They are different. The Clayton District began by demanding that there be full state funding, and there's a reason for them to begin there, because they were making a profit on every student who comes for whom they were able to charge tuition. If I may have just a moment, if they're right that you can't have payments from a third party that cover the obligation for this new requirement, then the whole majority opinion in Brooks is a dead letter. It makes no sense whatsoever because the whole discussion there was whether this third-party payment was enough. And because it wasn't enough, there was a problem. Under their theory, the third-party payment, it wouldn't have mattered if it was $1 or $1 million.
Can you $1 might have been de minimis, but can you clarify what is it your position that the city would have that the city school district would have to pay to Clayton?
The city school district, under the statute, has to pay to Clayton the tuition that is calculated pursuant to the statute.
And even though Clayton Clayton spends more per student than is required under state law.
Yes.
And does the city have to provide that additional amount?
The statute says that provides the formula through which the tuition payment is calculated. subject to consideration to the state board. That is, if you have a dispute about payments,
right.
you go to the state board.
Their money goes with them, and if there's a dispute between the school districts, then it goes to the state board.
They
go to the state board, and they decide what's fair.
Decide what under the statute would be the appropriate tuition.
Mr. Layton, may not be fair. If you could answer that, a more specific question, is the city obligated to pay the amount that Clayton voluntarily taxes its residents to educate its students above what any board or anything else would say is required?
No, if not,
are they supposed to give a worse education to the transferred students, or are they supposed to take money from the students who are already there and average it out?
The statute doesn't address how much the Clayton district is taxing.
Can it require the city to pay any amounts voluntarily paid by Clayton above what's required by the state? And if not, then it does seem like there's going to be two levels of education in Clayton or whatever other surrounding districts would take transferred students under your argument.
Well, let me react to the two-tier thing first. This case never gets to that. The way the statute works, the statute sets out a method for calculating tuition. And for the first few hundred students for Clayton, that amount of tuition is way, way above what it costs them, the marginal cost of those students, even at the amount that Clayton is spending per pupil. Okay? I mean, it's like $20,000, and there are school districts in St. Louis County that are doing this for seven or eight. But they get that full amount.
You can fill in empty spaces at very little cost for a while, and then when you get beyond that, then what happens?
There is some point at which the Clayton District would have to add buildings or mobile classrooms, or work on split scheduling, do something else that costs them more than that marginal cost per student. I don't know what it is. They didn't present evidence as to what it was. They decided that they were just going to do this all or nothing doomsday scenario approach.
This is helpful, but it's a different issue. What is it you're saying the city is required to pay? You're saying the board has an option to go between the state mandated amount and the total voluntary amount, and they have complete discretion there, and you have to accept it? What are the parameters of their discretion?
The statute sets out a formula by which each receiving district establishes its tuition rate. Okay? And so the Clayton District calculated that rate. It comes out to be about $20,000 per student per year, give or take.
Is that higher than what the city spends per student per year?
Yes.
So why isn't that, to the extent it's greater, isn't that an unfunded mandate for the city?
Well, then you get the question of whether us imposing a change in how they have to educate students that raises their costs is itself an expansion of a duty. This court has never addressed that question in the past.
Requiring them to pay more might not be an expansion of a duty?
Well, we do things all the time that end up having as collateral consequences that they have to pay more. The court has never said that every one of those is expansion of a duty, that when we tell you how to do something differently, it's always an expansion of a duty. But it could be. That's their argument, is that, their argument first is that paying tuition
what is
of
your
any amount
What is your response new. To that argument, I guess? And I'm sorry, this last question here.
Well, ultimately, they have a good argument that having to pay more is an expansion of a duty. And that's why we say that we go back to those first two points that I made. You have to determine whether we are giving them enough money to pay that additional amount. And in this instance, there's no proof that we are not giving them enough money, and the taxpayers, not the state, is obligated to make that proof. They did not make that proof.
Thank you.
Thank you very well argued from all sides. The court will take the case under submission.